So at this time, the court calls number 13-19-446-CV, James M. Beggs, Linda Landers, and Beggs Landers Law Firm, PLLC versus Clark Love and Hudson PLLC and Clark Love Hudson GP. What says the appellant?
The appellants are here, Your Honor. Wayne Parris on behalf of the appellants, James Begg, Linda Landers, and Beggs Landers Law Firm. We would like to reserve 3 minutes for a possible reply rebuttal.
All right. Mr. Levinson?
Your Honor, LeVon Hogan-Atanian for the appellees, along with co-counsel Dale Jefferson. We would appreciate our full 20 minutes, although, you know, if circumstances lead us to do it, we'll be happy to return some of that time to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Levitanian. That's correct, right?
Your Honor, it's Hovnatanian.
Hovnatanian.
Correct. Right. I can barely say.
I'm going to apologize in advance for that. I'm going to mispronounce your name all this afternoon.
Your Honor, no apology needed. I can barely pronounce it correctly myself. So.
Good. All right. Mr. Parris, you have 17. Can y'all both see the timer on the Zoom cameras?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Hovington, can you see the timer?
Your Honor, I'm looking for it.
It was up on our screen. It's no longer.
It's all right. I'll use my watch.
Well, Ms. Mills, is there a reason why Mr. Hovington can't see the clock?
Judge, the clock is live and going. He might need to just switch it over to gallery view so he can view all the screens at one time.
All right. It may be that once your time comes up, we will see it. If not, I will give you, if you still can't see it at the time you became your organ arminant, Mr. Appley, I will give them a verbal 2-minute notice.
Thank you,
if necessary.
Appreciate that.
That's the way we used to do it before the timer for the first 12 years I was on the court. So I think I can still do it. All right, Mr. Parris, you can proceed whenever you're ready for oral argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. This is an appeal from a denial of a TCPA anti-SLAPP motion out of the Wharton District Court. It is a interlocutory appeal, and it is a appeal that has to do with the TCPA as it existed prior to the original TCPAs existed prior to 9/1/2019. I think we both agree on that. The appeal has to do with certain communications that were the subject of the Wharton County District Court case that we view as a retaliatory case to my clients who are lawyers in North Texas filing a federal district court lawsuit accusing the lawyers who are the appellees in this case of a breach of fiduciary duties and seeking fee forfeiture and exemplary damages in the federal district court in Houston. Subsequent to filing that lawsuit, this lawsuit in Wharton County District Court was filed by the appellees against my clients, who are the attorneys for out-of-state women who have settled some TVM lawsuits in connection with their TVM claims and claim that the appellees breached their fiduciary duties in connection with that. Now, the lawsuit that was filed in Wharton County, Your Honors, is a lawsuit that sought to enjoin certain communications from my clients relating to these TVM settlements. Extrapolated from that, they claim that these communications were interference with contract and business relations. They claim that the communications were, in fact, enjoinable because they were related to TVM settlements They claim that they were involved in a conspiracy. And so my clients filed a motion to dismiss under the TCPA. And basically, there are two communications that are the genesis here of all of the revolving around all of the communications that they sought to enjoin, the appellees sought to enjoin in Warren County. The first is this communication, and it is attached to the original petition and the amended petition in the Warren County District Court case. It is a communication that does not even use the name of my clients, James Beggs or Linda Landers or the Landers Law Firm. There is a phone number, however, that goes to this communication. And it's a communication, judges, that is critical of these lawyers, the appellees' services, critical of those services. This communication was, they claim, sent to clients, their clients, in unmarked mailing envelopes and also published in and around Wharton County to the general public. And it may have been published before my clients, the appellants, actually filed a lawsuit for these women in federal district court in Houston. The other item that was attached to Mr. Suazo's affidavit was this communication. It says, we filed a lawsuit, and it sues some Houston lawyers over a breach of fiduciary duties. These are the major communications. Now, if you look at their response to
Mr. TCPA, Mr. Paris, I'd like to stop you there and talk whether you want to individually or separate apart the two communications, and I'll call them Flyer 1 and Flyer 2 just for argument's sake this morning. The first question that this court under a de novo review has to decide whether those communications under the anti-SLAPP statute are protected speech. Would you agree with me that that's the first prong that the court has to oversee?
That's correct. And our position is that we did prove our carry our burden of establishing by a preponderance of the evidence that these communications were protected speech under the TCPA. These let's talk about the first one first, Your Honor.
Well, let me, and before you talk about them, I want to put in my second question, which is under section 27.010B of the statute that says that these communications can't be protected. It's an exception under the anti-SLAPP if it is commercial speech.
That is correct.
How do you get around that these are not commercial speech? And you can address them together or separate, Mr. Paris, because I think that's where I have the hardest problem in this case, ascertaining.
All right, Your Honor, I'll go to the exemptions then, which is the commercial speech exemption, which is the first exemption that was responded to in the trial court. Castleman versus Internet Money, which is the Supreme Court case, states four elements of the commercial speech exemption. There, it is important that the court look at this particular case and those four elements. And the Supreme Court has made the statement in the Castleman case that the mere fact that the defendant, in this case the appellant, sells services does not prevent them from availing themselves of the TCPA dismissal process when they speak of other goods and services in the marketplace. That's exactly what this particular flyer number one, if the court will, does. With relation to flyer number one, it speaks of other goods and services in the marketplace. It speaks of goods and services, Your Honor, that were rendered by the appellees. not the goods and services that were rendered by the appellants. It says, so many women I know were sold down the river by their law firm. And it talks about women who have signed settlement paperwork for TCM with a lawyer. Please read this. And so,
how do you distinguish this case from the Miller case, which is out of the El Paso case, and it's Miller Weisberg versus LLP versus Yamas, the 2014 case that the appellee pretty much cites throughout their whole brief, which is very similar in the facts, which is that advertisement of lawyers in whatever apparatus that they use is commercial speech and therefore exemption under the anti-SLAPP.
Your Honor, I think that the Kasman case, in the Kasman case, which I believe is a 2018 case out of the Supreme Court, clarifies what is and what is not commercial speech. It lays out the four positions. It lays out the four elements. And here's my answer to that. Beggs Landers did not make the statement or encourage the conduct on which the claim is based in their capacity as the seller of services. The communications are not based upon their capacity as seller of services, but critical of the appellee's services in the appellee's capacities, not theirs. That would be the second element of the Kasman case. The third element, I don't think that the commercial speech exemption is met here, because Beggs Landers' statement of communication did not arise out of the sale of their services, a commercial transaction that they provided. It only arose out of the appellee's services that they had provided. And I don't think, with respect to flyer number two, which talks about the filing of a federal lawsuit, that the filing of a federal lawsuit is a commercial transaction. Simply put, the filing is based upon services provided by the appellees, which states a breach of fiduciary duty by the appellees. So, Your Honor, I believe that the exemption does not apply based upon the correct interpretation of the Kasman versus Internet Money case. And I think that both of these communications refer to appellee services in the marketplace. They do not refer to the appellant's services in the marketplace. And therefore, I think that they're protected under the good services provision of the of what is defined as matters involving public concern. And of course, we have the Ola, Villa, and Desai cases that says that speech that concerns lawyer services are matters of public concern. So I don't think they fall under the commercial speech exemption for those reasons. And I think, going back now to the original application of the scope of the TCPA, I think we met that based upon their pleading and based upon the affidavits. And we really weren't challenged on that in the trial court. And I think we're not challenged on it here. But there is another exemption that we have that have been raised by the appellees, and that's the bodily injury exemption.
Right.
Now, that says that the chapter does not apply to a legal action that is seeking recovery for a bodily injury or statements made regarding that legal action. The federal court lawsuits that the appellants have filed do not seek recovery for a bodily injury. And this is where we have to get into the fact that James Beggs has stated in his affidavit, and of course they've stated in their amended petition, that the recovery is sought for a breach of fiduciary duties, fee forfeiture, and exemplary damages. That's also set out in the in the other documents and set out in the motion to dismiss. Now, it was argued in the trial court. It was argued in the trial court by Mr. Jefferson, who's seated to next to Mr. Hovenaten. And I'm sorry for mispronouncing that name. But nevertheless, it was argued in the trial court that the case that was filed in federal court, Judge, is really a legal malpractice case. And therefore, it should be treated as a legal malpractice case. Therefore, in order to prove up a legal malpractice case, you've got to prove case within a case, and you have to prove up the bodily injury action, proving up a case within a case. Well, it is not a legal malpractice case. It is a breach of fiduciary duty case with a benefit running to the appellees. And if it is found that they breached their fiduciary duties, the court well knows, and in the old Supreme Court case of Burrow versus Arce, then you have equitable fee forfeiture of these TVM settlements, exactly what these published flyers have referred to. So we do not view that as a matter involving a bodily injury. My clients, the lawyers, did not sue for bodily injury. They did not sue on behalf of the ladies for bodily injury. They sued for breach of fiduciary duty and fee forfeiture. And to prove that up, you don't have to prove causation. You don't have to prove case within a case and get into any bodily injuries. And neither one of these flyers referred to flyer number one or flyer number two refer to bodily injuries. They refer to breach of fiduciary duties. So we don't think that the bodily injury exception applies there. And we don't think that statements made regarding that legal action applies there, Your Honors, under the bodily injury exemption, because nowhere in these flyers is even the case referred to specifically in Wharton County. These are generic flyers, and there was a lot made of them being not in compliance with the disciplinary rules. Well, that is a matter for the Chief Disciplinary Counsel of the State Bar. That is a matter for the Grievance Committee. That is a matter for licensing. So it looks like I'm down to about a minute and 52 seconds, correct?
That's correct. Of your first 15 minutes, of your first 17 minutes. So you still have
first 17 minutes. So I don't think that the communications that are here involved, the span of those communications are limited by any Texas disciplinary rule of professional conduct. If these communications, if these flyers don't comply with the disciplinary rules, that should be taken up with the Advertising Review Committee. Finally, Your Honors, I think that there is a problem here concerning I don't think that they have proved in any way, shape, or form the elements, specific elements of all of their causes of action stated, and I will refer to in that regard, I don't think I'll refer to the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals opinion in Urban Engineering versus Salinas and construction, wherein it is said that in order to prove, for them to prove, and they have the burden on this, each essential element of their claim, you have to provide a minimum quantum of unambiguous, explicit evidence necessary to support the rational inference that the allegation of fact is true. They haven't done that. They haven't linked those allegations together. And then finally, Your Honor, I have a legal defense to this, and that's the communicating privilege defense, as well as the attorney immunity defense. These are cases filed against people who represented the other side of the lawsuit on ladies that sued the appellees. I think I'm out of time.
You are, Mr. Perez, unless there's any questions from Justice DeCadena or Perks.
No.
All right. Mr. LaVentaine, we'll see if you can see the clock. If it comes on.
Your Honor, I don't see it, but that's okay. That's perfectly fine.
I can see it. I'll keep that. So I'll become your timekeeper. We have 20 minutes on the clock. I will tell you when you have, do you want a heads up at 2, 3, 4, 5 minutes?
2, Your Honor, would be great. And I really appreciate that.
No problem. I will let you know when you've hit the 2 minutes a lot of time.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm LaVon Hovnatanyan with co-counsel Dale Jefferson here for the appellees Clark, Love, and Hudson. The first thing I want to get to is the dispositive issue of the commercial speech exemption, and it is dispositive. If the exemption applies, the statute doesn't apply. The very first words of the commercial speech exemption are, "This chapter does not apply to," and then it describes the commercial speech exemption. The quintessential commercial speech exemption is attorney advertising. And that's what we have in this case. We have a textbook case of lawyer advertising. The Miller-Weisbrod Court, the Neely Court, the Shearer Court, the Texans Court, the Vogt Court, and the NCDR Court have all held that lawyer advertising is, as a matter of law, commercial speech.
I want to talk about the Miller case, because to me that resonates more in a factual basis with the case before this court, as lawyer advertisement under the issue of the anti-SLAPP and specifically this section of the statute. Mr. Parris, in his argument, refers us to the Castleman versus Internet Money case, which was the per curiam opinion of the Supreme Court in 2018, that says it, that is making the argument that it has added, I would say, an additional analysis that the court must go through to ascertain whether this is commercial speech or not. So does Castleman change your analysis of the Miller case that this court needs now to address in order to decide whether Miller is still correct under Castleman?
Your Honor, it does not change the analysis. Castleman is a great general rule case, and we have no quarrel with that case. But the fact is, Castleman did not involve attorney advertising. And Castleman didn't even involve an attorney. The attorney advertising cases are a separate subset of the TCPA under the commercial speech exemption. They all go the same way, and none of them violate Castleman. They all say, and I'm speaking specifically of Miller-Weisbrod and NCDR, which were in particular TCPA cases, they all say if there is attorney advertising going on, that is textbook commercial speech, and it falls within the commercial speech exemption, and therefore the TCPA does not apply. Now, turning to the facts of this case, there's no dispute in this case that what we have is attorney advertising. We can look to Mr. Begg's 2 affidavits. If it weren't perfectly obvious from the facts and circumstances themselves, even Mr. Beggs characterizes what Beggs Landers did as advertising, mailings, and advertisements. And that's in his 2nd affidavit, which is in the record on pages 425 to 26. In his 1st affidavit, he uses the same terms. He calls it advertisements and advertising. And that's page 206 of the clerk's record. So what we're talking about, these facts perfectly match the opinions that say lawyer advertising as a matter of law is commercial speech. Now, Your Honor, you referred to the Miller-Weisbrod case, and that is particularly analogous here. In Miller-Weisbrod, a law firm put on television commercials 15-second TV ads regarding lawsuits against an eye doctor, an ophthalmologist. The Court of Appeals, the El Paso Court of Appeals, said that is quintessential attorney advertising. You are trying to solicit clients. There's nothing wrong with that, but let's call that what it is. That is commercial speech. One of the arguments in that case and also in NCDR was, well, but look, we're trying to protect the public from a bad doctor. And so this can't be commercial speech because it's a matter of public concern. Both of those courts of appeals in Miller Weisbrod and NCDR said the same thing. To quote the Miller Weisbrod court, it's not a matter of public concern, but primarily to attract clients. And that is the line that's so important in this case. That's what makes this case textbook commercial speech, puts it within the commercial speech exemption, and removes it from the TCPA, as the trial court correctly determined. Now, Mr. Parris refers to the Avila case and the Deaver case. Well, like Castleman, neither one of those cases involved attorney advertising. And in fact, neither Avila nor Deaver even involved attorneys. The defendant in Deaver—
But doesn't Castleman, going back, doesn't Castleman, and I'm trying to find it where it is in the opinion because I forgot to flag it, give us an analysis to ascertain whether it's commercial speech or not. So whether we're looking at Miller, Castleman from the Texas Supreme Court still gives us, because it's an opinion analyzing what is commercial speech in the broad sense.
Yes, you are.
So if we apply, setting aside NCB and Miller, if we apply Castleman's four prongs, I think it's four, is this commercial speech?
It is, Your Honor. It is.
Why?
Well, because under the traditional statutory analysis, which Castleman embraces, you have to look, for instance, at what is the intent of these statements, okay? And in this case, you have the intent to propose a commercial transaction. You have lawyers contacting potential clients, offering their services for sale in the marketplace. Under Castleman or any test, that is purely commercial speech. What nails it down here and differentiates this case from Castleman is that it is attorney advertising, which is a subject that Castleman did not take on. But I completely agree with you. If you use the Castleman analysis and apply it to the facts in this case, it's still going to fall within the commercial speech exemption because lawyer advertising is always going to be commercial speech. It would be hard to envision a case in which it were not. In fact, no court in the state of Texas has been able to envision that case because every lawyer advertising case before and after Castleman has reached the conclusion that lawyer advertising is commercial speech. So the court can proceed under the six unanimous cases that say lawyer advertising is commercial speech. It can proceed under Castleman and do the four-part analysis. We respectfully suggest the conclusions should still be the same. Lawyer advertising is always going to be commercial speech. It fits directly within the statutory definition, and that's why there's unanimity in the case law on this issue before and after Castleman. And let me add a little specific note on the type of advertising that was done in this case. With no disrespect to Mr. Parris, it's not fair to say these were just flyers or that there were just two flyers. These were mail-outs, mass mail-outs to a huge targeted audience of TVM plaintiffs represented by CLH. And it's not just the mailouts that CLH is complaining about. They're also complaining about, in this lawsuit, what was done with their confidential and proprietary information in order to execute those mailouts. So there weren't just two flyers. There were a host of mailouts, and that's not the only thing that CLH is complaining about in this lawsuit. And that actually—
So does it matter that the flyers, as Mr. Paris points out, doesn't even mention his client?
It does not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Well, for two reasons. The first reason is, if we're going to go by that terminology, flyer number two has the Beggs Landers logo and name on it. So there's no question, there's no getting away from number two. Number one, the evidence in the record is that that came from Beggs Landers, despite the fact that it doesn't have their name or their logo on it. The evidence in the record is that was a mail out from Beggs Landers. So either way, those mail outs, there's no question in this record where they came from. No one else was sending out.
I can't recall right now, and I don't want to look for it. So I'm just going to ask you the question. Do the flyers mention your client's names? I can't recall on flyer one or two.
No, they do not, Your Honor. They were mailed directly to our client's clients. But they
didn't mention your name.
You are correct.
I wanted to make sure I was correct on that, because then my follow-up question is, how then can it be the advertisement against, as opposed to the Miller Weisfeld, which specifically named the doctor in the advertisement, in the sense of protected under this commercial, under the exception, because it's not addressed about if you were hired by this law firm, you know, your case was messed up. Does it matter that your firm was not named in order to ascertain whether it's a communication exception?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. It does not, for three reasons. The first reason is because flyer number two, let me back up. It does not, really, for two reasons, okay? The first reason is it's no coincidence that the mailouts were sent to the TVM plaintiffs that were represented specifically by CLH. And that is actually the second reason as well. These ladies only had one lawyer. They were only represented by one law firm, and that law firm was CLH. These weren't unfocused mass mailings. It was a targeted mass mailing to the TVM plaintiffs represented by CLH. And that evidence is in the record. In fact, that is how this came to CLH's attention. When one of the CLH clients was so offended by what she had received that she gave it to CLH. She gave the mail outs to CLH and told them, I think you've got a problem. And as it turned out, they did. And I mean, the rest of the story is reflected in the record. That led to this lawsuit. And that actually brings me to my next point, which is the character of this lawsuit. The character of this lawsuit is not retaliatory. The record shows that part of the consideration for the settlements between CLH's TVM clients and the manufacturing defendants was confidentiality. And Beggs Landers violated that confidentiality in two ways. The first way was when they gave interviews, for one, to a writer from the New York Times, who subsequently wrote an article that published some of the information that CLH and its clients had promised the trial court and the defendants that they would keep private and confidential. And the second way, remarkably, was that when Beggs Landers filed the federal lawsuit, much of the confidential information is spilled on the pages of the complaint. And so in at least two ways, Beggs Landers has violated the confidentiality agreement that was in place and part of the settlement agreements between the trial court, the defendants, the special master, CLH, CLH's clients, and the trustee. So we hope the court can understand how CLH would not want to be blamed for the dissemination of its confidential information for two reasons. Number one, they don't want to lose credibility because they have a lot of other pending cases with these same ladies, and they don't want to lose credibility either with the trial court or the defendants. And the second reason—
Mr. Huffington, you have 5 minutes left. And I didn't want you not to have time to address the bodily injury exception, as Mr. Parris says, you do not, you're not entitled to. So I wanted you to get to that issue before you ran out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. Well, we have discussed the dispositive issue of the commercial speech exemption. The bodily injury exemption, we respectfully suggest that court doesn't need to reach it. If the court does, we think the court will find that it applies. This is, in fact, a bodily injury. What the other side has done is raise a distinction without a difference by saying, well, breach of fiduciary duty and as opposed to legal malpractice. Well, first of all, that's not the law on this issue. Bodily injury, the bodily injury exemption was something that the Tyler Court of Appeals discussed in 2019, ironically, in a case called Tyler. That case involved a hospital lien, and the Tyler Court of Appeals said this hospital lien is in place because of, due to, a bodily injury, because of the man who was in the hospital who was so badly injured, which led the lien to be applied to approximately $600,000 of medical expenses. The Tyler Court of Appeals said the question is not whether the plaintiff in this case is complaining about a bodily injury. The question is, was the statements or the conduct in this case related to the bodily injury? In Tyler, the answer was yes, because the hospital lien was a statement relating to the bodily injury of poor Mr. Pridgen, who was in the hospital at the time. Just so in this case, the fact that CLH has not sued for a bodily injury is not dispositive. What's dispositive is that the statements and the conduct relate to a bodily injury, that being the various and serious bodily injuries of the TBM plaintiffs. And so standing on the Tyler case, that is why we say the bodily injury exemption applies if the court finds the necessity to reach it after it has considered the commercial speech exemption.
You have 2 minutes left to finish up your argument.
I will wrap up by going back to my point that CLH did not want the trial court or the defendants to hold them accountable for the breaches of the settlement agreement and confidentiality that the record shows were the fault of Beggs Landers. That's one reason the lawsuit was filed and requested declaratory relief that the judge say it wasn't CLH's fault, that requested injunctive relief that said Beggs Landers can't do this anymore, and also brought causes of action related to the dissemination of their trade secrets under, for instance, TUTSA and conspiracy theories. And so for all these reasons, we ask the court to affirm the trial court's order.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Parris, your 3 minutes for rebuttal will be on the clock in just a minute. And then you can start. There it is. All right, Mr. Parris, whenever you proceed
Your Honor.
Rebuttal, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, we rely upon the elements that the Supreme Court has set forth in Castleman, and we rely upon the Supreme Court's statement that the mere fact that the appellants in this case sell services do not prevent them from availing themselves of the TCPA dismissal process. When they speak of other goods and services in the marketplace, these generic flyers, these two generic flyers, which don't even mention Clark and Hudson law firm, speak of services offered by others in the marketplace. They speak of defective services, a matter of public concern. And we rely upon this Supreme Court case. And as far as the bodily injury exception is concerned, we state that in every case, if this was the law, and they're asking you to construe a breach of fiduciary duty case as a legal malpractice case. There is a Texas non-fracturing rule, as the court knows, but that's for Judge Hannon in the federal district court to decide. And there is a claim for equitable fee forfeiture in this case that does not touch the bodily injury, touches the settlement of the TCM case. And so we don't get to the bodily injury that way. They talk about intent of these flyers. They talk about what's behind these flyers. They talk about breach of confidentiality with regard to their settlement of cases in Wharton County. This is all a smokescreen, Judge. This is all a smokescreen to get around the fact that this particular injunctive action that was filed in Wharton was retaliatory to keep my clients from contacting any other women with a TVM claim settlement and to enjoin that such. And that's what was behind the lawsuit. It would have never been filed if they hadn't filed a federal case against these lawyers. And so we ask that the TCPA motion be sustained and this matter be rendered. And we ask that the case be remanded to the Wharton Court for determination of attorney's fees in favor of the appellants.
Counsel, cases that you found that dealt with attorney advertising and commercial speech, it's been represented that there are no other cases that obviously work in your position with regard to the commercial speech exception. So I was curious, have you found any attorney advertising cases that deal with this particular issue?
I haven't found any that, you know, Your Honor, but I haven't found any that disagree with the Castleman 4 points that we claim the second and third point are not applicable here.
Thank you.
If nothing further from Justice DeHitting or Justice Burke, this case will be in submission.